This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. In the heat of the night, the landmark movie starring Sidney Poitier as Virgil Tibbs, a Philadelphia homicide detective who investigates a murder in the bigoted Deep South, was re-released on DVD this week in a special 40th anniversary edition. Today on Fresh Air, we hear from Mr. Tibbs himself, Sidney Poitier. In the 1950s and 60s, Poitier starred in a string of films that addressed the racial tensions of the time. Films like The Defiant Ones, Lilies of the Field, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, and To Sir with Love. In 1963, he became the first African-American to win an Academy Award for Best Actor. Since then, Denzel Washington and Forrest Whitaker also have won Oscars in that same category. Terry Gross spoke to Sidney Poitier in 2000, at the time of the publication of his memoir, The Measure of a Man, a Spiritual Autobiography.
Let me talk with you about a scene from In the Heat of the Night. In that film, Rod Steiger plays a local police chief in a southern town. You're a homicide cop from Philadelphia passing through this southern town, but you're arrested for being suspicious because you're a black man from out of town carrying money in your wallet. The police chief doesn't really believe that you're a cop, so he calls your boss in Philly. And your boss suggests that you stay in this small southern town to help them solve this big murder case that they're working on, because they don't have cops who are nearly as experienced as you are. So in this scene, you and Rod Steiger, who's still very skeptical of you, go to question one of the leading white businessmen in town. And I'll just explain, in case it's confusing as our listeners hear it, that as you're questioning him, the businessman slaps you, and then without missing a beat, you slap him right back. Here's the scene.
Let me understand this. You two came here to question me?
Well, your attitudes, Mr. Endicott, your points of view are a matter of record. Some people, well, let us say the people who work for Mr. Colbert, might reasonably regard you as the person least likely to mourn his passing. We were just trying to clarify some of the evidence. Was Mr. Colbert ever in this greenhouse, say, last night about midnight?
Gillespie?
Yeah.
You saw it.
I saw it.
Well, what are you going to do about it?
I don't know.
I'll remember that. There was a time when I could have had you shot.
Sidney Poitier, in your new memoir, you say that's not the way the scene was originally written. Originally, you didn't slap this businessman right after he slapped you. What did you do in the original scene, and why did you want to change it?
The original scene called for the businessman to slap me and for me to absorb it and leave. I found it reprehensible that the writers writing for that period would not have written it differently. And I felt that the natural emotional response to being slapped, as, and I'm speaking not as Sidney Poitier, but I'm speaking as a Philadelphia detective, that the natural response to a man slapping him, he's going to slap him right back. And I elected as an actor to do that because were I the guy from Philadelphia who was slapped, I would slap the guy right back. And I thought that that would be, since those kinds of moments were never found in American films from the inception of films in this country, that kind of a scene, which would be electrifying on the screen, was always either avoided, not thought of, and I insisted that if they wished my participation in the film, that they would have to rewrite it to exemplify that. And it indeed did turn out to be a highlight moment in that film. But it also spoke not just of the two characters. It spoke of our time. It spoke of the time in America when in films, at least, we could step up to certain realities.
Let me advance the story a little further and take you to the early part of your movie career, specifically to Blackboard Jungle, which was released in 1954. This was an important film for you. You had one of the leads in it. This is like the most famous high school film, I think. It opens with Rock Around the Clock. Glenn Ford plays the new teacher at a school just filled with juvenile delinquents. And in your first scene, he catches you and some of the other guys smoking in the bathroom. You're washing your hands with your back turned toward the teacher for most of this scene. Let's hear this scene.
What's your name, wise guy?
Me? Miller. Gregory Miller. You want me to spell it out for you so you won't forget it?
No, you don't have to do that. I'll remember, Miller.
Sure, Chief, you do that.
Or maybe you'd like to take a walk down to the principal's office right now with me. Is that what you want?
You holding all the cards, Chief. You want to take me to see Mr. Warnicky? You do just that.
Who's your home period teacher?
You are, Chief.
Well, why aren't you with the rest of the class?
I already told you. Came in to wash up, Chief.
All right, then wash up. Just cut out that chief routine, you understand?
Sure, Chief. That's what I've been doing all the time. Okay for us to drift now, Chief?
I want to catch you in here again.
Suppose I got business here, Chief.
Look, how many times do I have to tell you? Let's go, huh? Come on, let's go.
Sidney Poitier, how did you like your role in Blackboard Jungle?
I liked it. I liked it. This young guy that I played, he was really on the cusp of finding himself in useful ways or losing himself to forces he couldn't quite understand by then. And so he had some complications, he had some complexities, he had some depth to him, and I liked playing him.
Well, you became the African-American leading man in the 60s. What were some of the things that you felt you weren't allowed to play or express as an African-American leading man in the 60s in Hollywood?
That is a very good question. And the true answer is I have no such imagery of what I was not able to express, because taking the times as they were, the fact of my career was in itself remarkable.
Right.
Just the fact of it, you see. It would have been a luxury I would not have spent much time on trying to determine what was missing. What was missing was not so much for me, but what was missing for the overwhelming majority of other minority actors at the time.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. What were some of the things you heard from your fellow actors at the time about stereotype roles that they had to play in Hollywood when you came to Hollywood?
Yeah, well, you know, most of us, I think, were obliged to play what was available. I did not take advantage of that. I couldn't. It was not what I needed to do for my life. I had elected to be the kind of actor whose work would stand as a representation of my values.
Sidney Poitier speaking to Terry Gross in 2000. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2000 interview with Sidney Poitier. One of his groundbreaking films, In the Heat of the Night, has just been re-released on DVD in honor of its 40th anniversary.
Would you describe Cat Island, the island in the Bahamas where you grew up?
It's difficult to describe, in that words would be hard to find to convey the beauty of it. You know, we have the most extraordinary beaches in the world. The water is of a color and of a luminance that is absolutely striking. And the life was such that you walked everywhere you went, and if you had any heavy loads to carry, you would use a mule or a horse or a donkey and stuff like that.
When you were 10, your family moved to Nassau, I think because there was, what, a crop failure on the island? And...
Well, they were tomato farmers. That's how they earned their living. And they sold to the to the middle guys in Florida. And they did that for many, many years. And when I was about 9 and a half or so, the U.S. government in Florida, on behalf of the Florida tomato growers, placed an embargo on tomatoes coming out of the Bahamas for reasons, I suppose, beneficial to the local farmers in Florida. But that devastated the whole farming of tomatoes in the Bahamas, throughout the islands in the Bahamas, and especially on Cat Island, which affected my father. And he, having no other means of making a living, had to move the family to Nassau, which was and still is a tourist community and a tourist economy. And he had to find work as best he could somewhere in that new culture.
What kind of work did he find?
Well, not much. He found a job, ultimately working for someone in a bicycle store. And he wanted to continue farming, but the soil available was not resilient enough to be useful.
You left for Florida, where your brother was living with his family, when you were age 15. You planned to stay with him. You didn't stay for long. What was it like to face Southern segregation?
Well, it was an experience, I can tell you. There was some semblance of it in Nassau when we moved from Cat Island to Nassau. There was none of it, none, absolutely none of it on Cat Island. I never developed any sense of what color would eventually come to mean in the other parts of the world. And was really unprepared for what I found in Florida at the age of 15.
Did you do things in Florida that were considered terrible mistakes because you didn't understand what segregation meant?
I remember once my brother, with whom I was living once I had arrived there, helped me to get a job within a matter of weeks at Burdine's department store. And at Burdine's department store, I was given a delivery job because I could ride a bicycle. And I used to ride the bicycle from downtown Miami to Miami Beach to deliver packages for the pharmaceutical division of the store. I went to Miami Beach once to take, as a matter of fact, on my first day, to take a package to a home. I had the address, and I went to the address, and I rang the bell, and a lady came to the front door, and she saw me standing there, and I said, good evening, ma'am, and I came to bring you your package, and she slammed the... No, first she said, get her out to the back door. Well, I'm 15 years old. I don't know the rules. And I couldn't understand why I needed to go to the back door, because there she was standing there at the front door. And there I was, smiling with the package in my hand and expecting her to take it. And I said, well, here I am, ma'am, and here's the package. And I handed it to her, and she screamed at me to get around to the back door. So she slammed the door in my face at that point, and... still not understanding fully, I decided that the best thing to do is to put the package down on the steps. And I left it there. And I left. And I went home. Actually, it was 2 days later. I returned from my work at home, and it was in the evening, and it's the house is dark. And I wondered why there were no lights on in my brother's house. And as I approached the front door, the door opened suddenly, and my sister-in-law grabbed me and pulled me in and pulled me to the floor where the rest of the family was, kind of like huddling. And she said to me, "What did you do?" I said, "I didn't do anything." "What do you mean? What did I do?" She says, "What happened?" And she explained to me that the Klan had come to the house looking for me, and that was like an introduction, first of all, to the term Klan. I never heard it where I came from. And my curiosity was such that I wondered. I wasn't so much concerned about the Klan because I had no experience and no frame of reference. What I was concerned about was how the effect it had on the family. And stuff like that. There were other instances and incidents in Florida that were representative of the time. You know, America was a different place early 1943.
Your first audition was as a result of a classified ad that you'd read for the American Negro Theater, which was looking for performers. You say when you got to your audition, you had trouble just reading the script. You certainly hadn't been in an audition before. You had no training. But you didn't have much schooling either.
No, I didn't.
How much schooling did you have, and what were your reading skills like at the time?
Well, my schooling, I started school in Nassau at the age of 11, and I had to quit. Actually, I started school at the age of 10 and a half, like 2 weeks after I arrived. And I had to quit at the age of 12 and a half. Because my father was not a man of material means, and therefore every hand in the family needed to lend itself to the family's survival. So I had to go out to get a job, and I did, in fact, get a job at 12 and a half. I suppose that my folks had anticipated my eventually going back to school, but it never happened. So that when I got to New York, I'm able to read, but very, 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 I can't imagine what level, what grade level, but it wasn't terrific. So when I went into this place, I could read, for instance, the want ad pages, and I could recognize words like janitor and dishwasher and stuff like that. Just across the page from the want ad page was the theatrical page, and there was this sign that said Actors Wanted. And I went to this address. I said, maybe I can. I tried dishwashing and janitors and all that stuff. Maybe I'll try this. And I went there, and there was a gentleman there alone in this place. It looked like it was an empty room with lots of empty chairs and a small, what I've learned was a stage. And he asked me, he said, are you an actor? And I said, yes, I am. He said, where have you acted? I said, in Florida. And he said, okay. He gave me a script and sent me up on this little stage. And he said, turn to page 28. And I did. I read the page and then the following page. And then I said, okay, I'm ready. And he said, okay, you start. I said, all right. And I started reading. Well, of course, I had never read for anyone in my life, except maybe in the elementary area in my first year in school in Nassau. So I started out. I said, so where are you going tomorrow? So the chap, I guess his eyes flew open, and he looked up on the stage, and it all came to him, you know, that I was a fake. So he came running up onto the stage, and he snatched the script out of my hand, and he grabbed me. I was a kid, you know, and he spun me around, and he grabbed me by the scruff of the neck and my belt in the back, and he marched me to the door. On the way, he said, these were his words as I remember. He said, get out of here and stop wasting people's time. He said, why don't you go out and get yourself a job you can handle? And as he opened the door and as he chucked me out, his last line to me was, get yourself a job as a dishwasher or something. Well.
Well, why'd you come back for more after that?
Because, as I'm walking down the street, heading to the bus stop to take a bus toward the area where the employment offices were, where I would be going to get a dishwasher's job, I said to myself, how did he know that I was a dishwasher? That's how I made my living in New York City. And I remembered not having told him that I was a dishwasher. So I concluded that he presupposed that that would be my limit. I would fall comfortably in that frame or some such frame. My potential was characterized by his suggestion. And I thought that I cannot let that happen. I would be less than I would like to be if he turned out to have been prophetic when he made that comment. So I decided, as I headed for the bus station, that I was going to become an actor. I was so offended by what he said. And I was going to go back and show him that he was wrong in his assessment of me. That's precisely how it happened.
Well, I thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Sidney Poitier, speaking to Terry Gross in 2000. In the Heat of the Night, in which he starred as Detective Virgil Tibbs, has just been re-released as a special 40th anniversary DVD. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.